market,
the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that invests like a woman and is proud of it. I'm Andrew Page, and with me, Mr. Scott Phillips.
G'day, Andrew. G'day, fools. That's an ominous start, but I'm trust you're going to save me from it at some point.
I am going to do my best. Mate, it was International Women's Day throughout the week.
It was.
So I thought, what an opportune time to honour the women in our lives.
Excellent.
And the women in our industry. So we'll definitely talk a bit about that, but also, what happened to volatility?
You saved that nicely, just quietly.
What do you mean?
You're getting better. Ordinarily, a start like that, I would have to stop it and restart the podcast, and that's pretty good.
As far as listeners know, mate, this is our 15th attempt at the start.
Mate, that's why you don't ever shine behind the curtain.
That's right, yeah. Exactly. So volatility, it was a pretty big deal not that long ago, and it's all gone. So what's up with that? Also, as I said, International Women's Day, the sorry state of the finance world there. As I said, we've got a lot to be thankful for the women in our lives, but there's just not enough of them in the finance industry, and it's a great shame, and we'll talk about that. Also, when politicians attack the economic benefits of tariffs and immigration, or not. And, mate, we haven't talked about it for a while.
What's that?
We're bringing Bitcoin back.
Bringing it back.
We're going to have a quick
JT style
Bitcoin. It's just completely fallen off the public agenda, but we're not going to let go of it that easily. And we'll do a bit of mailbag as well. How does that sound?
We've got a very busy show.
Let's get on with it. So, mate, at the start of the year, we had a... how much did the market fall in a couple of days? Close to 10%.
Yeah,
so,
got to 8 or 9%, I think, at least in Australia, and pretty close to 10 in the US.
So what they call a technical correction.
I hate that term.
Why do you hate it?
Well, because why does the market only ever correct downwards? When the market goes up 10%, we never have 10% correction
true.
Up, right? So the kind of idea of like, over time, the market, you asked, your fault.
Okay. Just as Andrew Page's fault. I thought it was worth digging into.
So the market goes up more than it goes down, right? Over history, the market goes up. If anything, a correction should be when it goes up back to the usual trend.
Right.
Why is it only correct downwards? It's bizarre. There is no term for a 10% rise in the market, but a 10% fall is a correction, like somehow we got smart and the market fell again.
Well, there's your mission for the week. You need to coin a phrase or term that refers to a 10% quote-unquote correction on the upside. Whoa, let's move on from that very quickly. So what happened, mate? How come there were headlines written? There were furious
we'll all commentary. Be ruined, said Hanrahan.
Yeah, what happened? Where did it go?
Well, so here's why we want to talk about this, because where did it go is one question. The other thing is just a reminder that at the time, it was all anybody wanted to talk about. We had letters, we had tweets, we had people not exactly running through the streets, but, you know, there was concern in the headlines about how bad the market was, how this was the beginning of the end.
You know, serious when you watch the news and finance leads the bulletin.
Exactly.
Normally it's just before the weather or something. And
I'm going to tip they went with X billion dollars wiped off the market.
Oh, you got to love that.
How good's that?
That sounds so much better.
That's when the sub-editors get a day
something
off.
Went down 3%. Nah, $50 billion wiped off
the share market.
That is much better.
That's when the subby gets a day off. It's like, I've already got the headline, guys. I'm going for lunch.
Right.
So the thing was that so early February, US non-farm payrolls came out. US bond yields went from 2.85 to 2.89% or something stupid, and all of a sudden the market lost its collective mind.
I loved that term. I'm gonna keep it alive as long as possible. Bond Kano was the term that was thrown around quite a bit.
Just quietly did after the pump dump or Trump dump. You know, I haven't got a good track record with
Bond Kano.
You go with Bond Kano.
I wasn't mine, by the way. I'm just a fan because I think it's ridiculous.
So here's the thing, right? That was the story. The story was, it was such a big deal. It was all over. It was a terrible, all the stuff that was going to go horribly wrong. This was the harbinger of doom, all that kind of good stuff. The market got really, really overexcited and then kind of just went back to normal. And I think that's probably why it's worth looking back on these things. So at the time, we will say in this room, hey guys, don't worry, it's just volatility, it happens. And some of our listeners will go, yep, we know. Others will go, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? Or,
surprise, but I'm
seriously freaked out.
Yeah.
I think it's worth looking back only a month later and going, you know what? That kind of was that was what happened. And so next time this sort of thing happens, remember back to this podcast and say, that's right, the guys said it was going to happen, it happened. We all got over it. That's what markets do. That's kind of the key lesson from the volatility.
Devil's advocate here. Is it a little bit too soon to sort of say, ha-ha, you know, market got its knickers in a knot about nothing? I mean, as you say, it's a month later.
Right.
Who knows? Things could crash 40% tomorrow.
Yeah, and they could. And that's always been true. In fact, there were people waiting since 2008 for the next recession, right? And if you've been out of the market for 10 years, you've cost yourself a very, very large amount of money. So yes, there will, the next crash will come, and we've said many, many times it is coming, but trying to jump at each possible reason for it, each possible start of it, eventually we'll be in this room saying, don't worry about it, and there will be that recession, right? Or there will be that market slump. And we'll be wrong, and I'm happy to be wrong because I've been right the other 45 times, and overall that's the kind of story, right? The up-rection that I'm calling it.
See, we can all,
have a term.
That is such a terrible term.
No?
No.
No? All right.
No, I don't know. If I have to explain to you why no, then we're in trouble.
I don't understand.
Don't you? Okay. No. Well, I'm not explaining it on air.
So
you and your up-rection.
But that's the thing, right? So, you know, the market will go up more than it goes down. It will occasionally slump badly, like the GFC. But investing during that is kind of the point. There'll be a heap of false starts. And if you were to jump out of the market at every possible false start, you would cost, you'd almost never be invested, firstly. And secondly, it'll cost you an absolute fortune in terms of missed opportunity.
I like to use an analogy of...
Does it involve the word up-rection?
No, it doesn't. Okay. Man, that's just so wrong. I like the analogy between climate and weather. So let's say you're building a house.
Yes.
And maybe that's an analogy for building a portfolio.
Erecting a house, yes.
A house. This has gone very juvenile very quickly, this podcast.
You took us there.
What are you talking about?
I replaced the syllable with core with up, and you've taken us in a different direction.
Anyways.
You're erecting a house.
So you're building a house.
Right.
And what do you do? You kind of look at the general climate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might be doing it in northern Queensland, where it tends to be pretty hot, pretty sunny.
And I should say, by the way,
a bit of a storm.
Our thoughts to our North Queensland listeners who are going through a horrible, horrible flood.
Absolutely, yes, yes.
So we hope you guys are doing okay.
Yes, definitely. Does it mean just because it's normally really, really hot and that you should be building a house that is designed for very, very cold weather? Does it mean that you can't have very cold weather there? Is it, in fact, inevitable that you will at certain points in time? And I think that's why it's a good analogy for the market, is that the market climate is one of generally really great long-term wealth creation.
Right.
But you are going to have some pretty torrid weather along the way.
Okay.
And you know, maybe I'm torturing the analogy here, but I think the distinction is clear. It's all sort of rain and sun and wind and all of that kind of stuff, but there's a longer term sort of pattern and there's shorter term differences.
I do like that idea. Just because you have a cold day in the middle of December doesn't mean you're not in the middle of summer.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
I like it.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, International Women's Day.
Yes. Thursday the 8th.
And I said it was a bit of a sorry state of the finance world. And it's one of these industries where it is really male dominated.
Right.
It's a real sausage party, if I can say it, in our industry, which is a shame, right?
And you're worried about me taking you in a strange direction with up-rection.
It was always going to go there. So, okay, the first question is why? Yeah. Why are there a bunch of dudes in finance? Why are there not more ladies?
Look, I mean, I could speculate, and I'm happy to, because that's what we do on this podcast.
Yes.
To some degree, the world of finance has been characterized by a whole lot of traits that are considered masculine. So risk-taking and making big bets and kind of talking a good game, out there selling to clients. Mm-hmm. Those are generally, and these are horrible, horrible just stereotypes and generalizations, but those are traditionally considered masculine traits. And so the risk-taking nature of, you know, trading floors, of brokerages, of all that kind of good stuff has tended to come with a male flavor. And so to some degree, those who are hiring are looking for people probably like themselves, because they themselves probably got promoted because they had some good results doing all those sort of things. And so you end up with this kind of weird scenario where it becomes very, very male dominated. And because of that kind of broad culture, and again, we're horribly generalizing, it tends to be pretty unfriendly for women to join the industry because of that.
Yeah.
A, the people we're looking for, and then B, the culture that tends to predominate, at least traditionally in these sort of areas. It's hard, you know, it's tempting to say, well, things are changing, you know, we're not like we were 50, 60 years ago, and that's probably true to some degree. But the numbers then still don't suggest that that's actually changing in a material way, and there's still way too many blokes and not enough women in the ranks of the finance industry.
Beyond just for the, you know, balance argument, what really I find surprising, and there's a lot of really good research that supports this, is that women tend to be much better investors.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they lack all of these horrible masculine characteristics of the arrogance and the ego and the rest of it. So this is true outside of finance, but certainly true in finance, where women tend to be much more consultative. So it's, you know, I like this business, but what do you think about that? You know, let me engage with you. Let me get a different perspective. Let me really take that on and weigh that up. As a guy's like, no, I'm right, you're wrong, and let me show you why. Women are almost always better at admitting mistakes mm-hmm. as well, as mm-hmm. guys will just never, ever admit that they've made a mistake. And again, yes, that's a really, really important characteristic. Yeah. And the list goes on and on right. and on and on.
Feminine traits of patience, for example.
Oh, yeah,
of,
patience, another great one. Yeah.
Of being slow to act rather than impulsive and kind of taking the flyer, taking the risk. There's a great book actually published by one of our former staff in the US. So probably a slight conflict here. So calling it out now. Warren Buffett Invests Like a Girl.
Oh, that's a great book. Yeah,
and
yep.
and it goes through that the traits that have made Buffett, you know, a very, very good investor are those traits that we tend to associate. And you've just mentioned most of them tend to be female traits. And in fact, Fidelity, the big fund manager in the US, did a review of all of its accounts and found that women's results overall were about 0.4% per year better than blokes.
Yes.
Now that seems like a small amount, but you compound that over 20, 30, 40 years.
Yes.
Women, you know, both in terms of the traits that are traditionally feminine, again, we won't stereotype everybody, but those who show those feminine, traditionally feminine traits tend to invest better. And women themselves as a group actually do, according to Fidelity at least, have a better result in their investing. So there are some lessons there. I know we had on our Facebook page some people saying, oh, that's sexist. You can't say women are better if I said that about men, da, da, da. I'm happy not to engage with that.
A bizarre perspective from social media. Who would have thunk it?
A very thoughtful. Yeah. But the point actually was, even if that was all true, which is not, the data actually speaks for itself. And so you can rail against it. You can label it with whatever. We're not apologizing for anyone. We're not trying to be politically correct. This is just the simple reality. And the lesson here is, if you're a woman, take a greater role in your own investing life, because you're probably going to do better than the blokes in your life.
Yep.
And if you're a bloke, have a think about that and realize that if women are doing it better in terms mm-hmm. of the data and in mm-hmm. terms of the traits, there's probably something in there for you as a bloke, as an investor. If you can adopt some of those traits, you're probably likely to do much better.
I mean, I'll give you a little bit of a hack, a little bit of a life hack, if you will, that I tend to use before we move on.
You've been on social media too long, haven't you?
Definitely. Life hack. I'm trying, the kids are saying it, so I'm trying to be cool.
Yeah, and the puzzle would have been, here's an idea.
Trying being the operative word. So my lovely wife, we've been together for a long time. She's just not an investor. She doesn't find it interesting. Mm-hmm. She rolls her eyes when I start talking to her. She's very patient.
To be fair, that's probably less about investing than about
it's
you.
It's probably
personally.
More about me than investing. Yeah. And yeah, it's not. Now you say it, it's like almost every topic she does that. But I have this wonderful, because, well, look, it's all our money, you know, our finances are all together. And I have this not so much a rule, but this thing that I like to do is, before I buy or sell anything, I run it past her over the kitchen table.
Nice.
And it's because she doesn't have this huge amount. Like, so sometimes you can get too close to stuff.
Yeah.
And she'll say, she asks all the sort of obvious questions, but all the good ones. Like, okay, well, why do you want to buy that? Why do you think that's good?
Yeah.
Why do you have to buy it now? Do you really need to buy it now? Or is it something that could wait a month? Or,
to be fair, are we talking about stocks here, or the latest computer game that you want to buy? Because they're probably the same.
It happens a bit with computer games, I'll admit.
Really? Why do you want to buy that now?
Honey,
it's great.
You're a grown man and you're, okay. But I think it's that idea of, if you know, if you've got a better half in this life, involve them in the conversation. They will bring a great deal of sense and rationality to the discussion, and they'll make you a better investor.
Smart. I like it, mate.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Okay, I mean, let's get political. Oh, now, this is always dangerous.
I'm hearing
right?
Olivia Newton-John's "Let's Get Physical" in my head now. And that's your fault. Let's get political.
No, that was only you, by the way. That was no one else. So the reason I always hesitate with this is that you're almost certainly going to, like, half your audience mm-hmm. is just going to hate you all of a sudden here. So we have to put a whole
all
bunch
of a sudden.
Of more than normal.
I figure by actually being slightly partisan here, we'll actually bring some of them back.
Okay.
75% of people that normally hate us, half will come back to us. That's a win.
Okay. Well, I'm just prefacing it, and
you're scared,
and
aren't you?
We have to. I am a little bit, because you know, we've got our views, but you know, politics is all about the art of compromise, and you know, I'm a big fan of, sort of, if you've got a good argument, you know, reason will speak for itself, and unfortunately, these things can devolve into sort of shouting matches. But we sort of wanted to, it's in the news a lot at the moment, because Mr. Trump's out there talking about tariffs, and there's a lot of people who are scared about trade wars, and it sort of brought all of this back into the headlines. Mm-hmm. And so we thought, well, actually, we do a money podcast, maybe we should talk about that as well.
Right.
And the latest thing is with steel and aluminium. Now, it looks as though this law that he's about to sign, Australia may well be exempt from. But let's imagine that it wasn't. Why is a tariff... Well, actually, let me go back a step. Explain... I love to do this because I throw you the hard ones.
Thank you.
Explain to me what a tariff is.
A tariff is a way of adding effectively price to an import to make your local goods seem more attractive by comparison.
Like a tax?
Kind of, yeah. So, yeah. But it's effectively an import tax applied to a certain class or type of product based normally on a political / policy decision that you want to give your own industry a leg up at the expense of the imported product.
So there might be something that you could import much, much, much cheaper.
Right.
Everyone's going to, like, price is obviously a very important signal in the economy. Yes. Why buy the locally produced one when you can get it from, say, China or somewhere like that at a fraction of the cost?
So the easiest example
You want to protect your industry is the big one.
Right. The easiest example is cars in Australia. So for the longest time in the 70s and 80s, we had very steep tariffs on imported cars because the Australian industry couldn't compete unless the imported product was slightly more expensive. So what do? You jack up the price of the imported cars. That means you can sell more Holdens and Fords in Australia, made in Australia, based on effectively the price difference or lack thereof.
Now, again, I'm trying to tread carefully here. We've actually touched on this topic before.
We have.
We both came down to the point of view as like, well, fantastic, go with the cheaper one. And it sounds horribly insensitive.
Yep.
You know, why wouldn't you want to protect local jobs? Why wouldn't you want to protect local industries? Surely it makes a great deal of sense.
So look, you're
and that's what Trump's trying to do, by the way,
yeah, exactly.
right? With the steel industry over in the US.
You're much more careful and gentle than I am. I'm going to blow up your entire intent of being too careful.
I was hoping you would. I was hoping you would.
Which is only to say that we don't have a political view on this one in particular. In fact, for what it's worth, both parties in the US, for example, other than Donald Trump, are actually arguing for tariffs not to be introduced. This is kind of a one-man band from Donald Trump. And so if you...
thought bubble, perhaps?
You think?
Yeah, I don't know.
A tweet at 3 a.m. I was watching Fox and Friends. Anyway, oh back to the topic.
Anyway, so this is the thing. Not partisan.
It's not a... well, that's the thing, right? So it's not a partisan question. It's a question of the economics of tariffs simply don't add up. And that's where it's challenging, right? It's a really... If you're not particularly a policy wonk, and I don't think anyone's ever accused Donald Trump of that, it's very simple. And the common sense approach would be, hey, I can protect local jobs by making the imports more expensive. Mm-hmm. We'll sell more Australian cars if I put a tariff on imported cars.
Yep.
We want to protect local industry, therefore it's a positive. And that makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge with tariffs, and this is why the economists need to kind of be able to win this argument in a war of ideas, is that tariffs are one of those policies that have, and this is a little bit of economic jargon, a little bit of kind of a concept with a kind of a nice little name. It has what they call concentrated costs but diffuse benefits.
Mm-hmm.
That is, let's say, and so the car industry in Australia is a classic example, right? We've now effectively got rid of all tariffs and all Australian manufacturing has gone.
Yep.
There's very concentrated costs for the couple of car companies and for the couple of thousand workers, and they are real costs and real impact on those people.
Definitely.
Very concentrated costs, though, because it doesn't hurt me, it doesn't hurt you, it doesn't hurt the other 24.5 million Australians. Mm-hmm. It just hurts those couple of thousand employees of car companies and some of the suppliers that supplied them. Mm-hmm. So that's really concentrated costs. The difference, though, is all of us are now going to pay $1,000, $1,200, $1,500 less per car.
Mm-hmm.
So
more per car, you mean?
But less now the tariffs are gone.
Oh, right, okay. Yep.
So now the cars we're buying from overseas are now cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really ever kind of say, oh, my car, you would have cost us $36,000, now it costs $34,000. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give the government a big tick. Or I love this no tariff policy. You don't see it because it doesn't come off the price. It's not like we say, well, here's a tariff discount that you're all of a sudden saving because there's no tariff.
Mm.
So you don't really recognise that. But every Australian who buys a new car over the next decades, literally, will pay less because there are no tariffs.
Mm.
That $1,000 you save, you're going to go and spend on a holiday, on a new computer, on a manicure, on a new pair of boots or shoes, on something else. So that money goes back into the economy in a different way. And rather than buying just one car, you now have one car and one iPhone.
Yes.
Or one car and one computer, or whatever it is. And so one car and one more holiday.
Mm.
And that's real economic benefit for you because you now got two things where you would have had one before.
Yep.
And it injects money back into the economy. And this is the problem.
That's the thing with international trade. It's not someone wins, someone loses.
Exactly.
The idea is that everyone is better off. Well, everyone on average is better off.
We get more Chinese-made phones.
Yes.
And in return, more Chinese tourists come to Australia, not as a one-for-one, but the fact that we don't have any tariffs on education, on tourism, and we have no tariffs on phones, means we get the best of both worlds. They get the best of both worlds. We're all better off as a result.
Here's the way I like to think about it. So Australia could get into the mobile phone manufacturing game.
Yes.
And we just wouldn't be that good at it. We don't have the various cost advantages and the scale and all the rest of it. So, but we can build them in another way, which is by digging up a bunch of iron ore or growing a bunch of wheat, chucking it on a boat, The boat goes off into the ocean, and it magically comes back with that wheat and iron ore and all the other stuff we export, magically turned into the things we want. We use what we have as a comparative advantage. We have really good quality minerals in our earth. We are really good at farming. We are good at a whole bunch of stuff. So why not focus on that other people can't do, and use that to using the magic of the capitalist economy to turn that into the things that we want at a price that we could never achieve ourselves.
Exactly. So we can have one expensive bad phone and cheap wheat.
Yes.
If we only had Australian-made products.
Yep.
Or we can have a cheap, good quality phone and good wheat and money left over.
We look at a lot of the sort of ex-Soviet bloc countries where they tried to do everything themselves.
Right,
they had everything, but that was all of a really poor standard.
Correct. So look, I get the politics, and we try desperately not to be political here or even partisan. We try and lean on good economics and good theory, and the simple reality is that there is no serious economist who thinks that the economy is better off with tariffs. Now, you and I have both said in the past, and we would say again, we absolutely believe, or I certainly believe, I'm sure you'd agree with me, in good quality support for those people who are displaced because of trade.
Oh, yeah, so let's not throw them on the rubbish heap.
Right,
definitely.
Exactly. So we're not saying those people don't matter, their jobs don't matter. What we are saying, though, is we're better off helping those people adjust to a new economy rather than artificially propping it up and going back to Soviet-style protectionism.
Well, the savings that we make in the economy, we can do it. Here's some retraining. Here's some compensation. We're absolutely helping these people out, but also helping ourselves out at the same time. You know what? Before we move on, what I find really interesting about all of this is that economics is what you'd call a soft science. It's not like physics where I can do a double slit experiment or something. I can just prove, you know, categorically that the electron has these various properties. And then you can do it, I can do it, Liam can do it. We can do the same experiment. We always get the same result. Economics, the social sciences, are a little, humans are involved, so it's not so black and white.
But spoken like a true science major, dude.
You gotta love science. You gotta love reason and rationality.
Oh, here we go.
I've got Elon Musk on my shirt right now.
You do,
because I'm a tragic and
I will take a photo and we'll tweet that out on our Motley Fool account, just for those who are following along.
Save us, Elon. You're doing it right now, aren't you?
Yeah, but keep talking.
What my point was is that we actually have a whole bunch of test tubes. So this isn't some stuffy-nosed professor having a discussion in a lecture hall somewhere, having a debate with someone else who has a different ideology.
Right.
We have decades and decades and decades of real life, other countries that have tried these things and they just didn't work. It's like we've ranted before on this notion of, which unfortunately is coming back a bit in the States, of trickle-down economics. It's one of these things that at a certain level you kind of think, yeah, I get that. But we don't have to rely on theory anymore. We have real world examples, many, 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 many examples over a long, 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 long period of time. And you know what? It just doesn't work.
Correct.
So we have data that supports this. And I think when it comes to tariffs and these kinds of things, we're always, you know, there's always going to be a little bit of ideology in there.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, when you can support your argument with a whole bunch of data, it sure helps.
You know it.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Bitcoin.
Yes.
Let's talk about Bitcoin.
Shall we?
Well, it's just so fallen out of the public consciousness, which is a good thing, I think, on balance.
Only because you don't have any.
I generally like to talk about it when it's been falling.
Don't you?
You generally
I've
like
noticed
to talk about
that.
When it's been going up. So I said to you this morning, mate, we haven't talked about that for a while, under the false assumption that it actually had been falling a lot, but I think it's come back up a bit.
Well, it depends on kind of what day you've looked at it,
What's your $100 worth today?
My $100 today is worth $160.11.
You're up 60%.
I know.
Oh, that's really disappointing.
You know what's funny?
All right, let's move on.
I mean, I care so little, actually don't check between podcasts. It's the podcast I go, I wonder how much the Bitcoin's
worth.
I
wonder what it is.
Yeah. So, but I did check at one point, so it was $130 last time I think we chatted about it. And I think I checked at some point during the week for some reason, I can't remember why, and it was up to $200. Like, great.
Hey.
And then it's now down to 160. So it depends on what day you ask.
So it really fell from the start of the year through to February. Like it went down, I want to say 50% at least. It went to 20 odd thousand to maybe even 9,000 or so.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And so it's back up a little bit.
Yeah. Doing about 30,000 Australian bucks. So it's doing okay. Oh, look, we spend too much time on it. It's a bit of a sideshow.
I only wanted to bring it up because I thought it was still down a lot. Not down as much as to make me happy. So let's move on.
It makes me internally happy that it's up still.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
How are we going for time?
We've got time for a few mailbags.
Let's do mailbag and let's finish up.
All right. So we got a bunch here. I wanted to give a shout out to Alex Lindblad at Alex J. Lindblad, B-L-A-D. Thanks for listening, mate. He makes the point. He lives in Germany and invests in the US. So naturally, he listens to us. We'll take it.
It's going to be better podcast he can listen to, sure.
Don't tell him that.
All right.
But he asked an excellent question, which is, will you describe the mechanics of share buybacks? Are those shares out of the public market? What happens to them? Thanks. Thanks for your comments. So, let me do this. I'll take this one.
All right.
So, a share buyback is when a company buys its own shares, and then after it buys them, it tears them up. They cease to exist.
Right.
Now, why would a company do that?
You said you were taking.
Okay, yeah, okay.
I'm happy to answer. You want to?
Are the currency with which we deal with when we're buying. We're not buying the entire company. We're buying a representation of the company.
Proportional ownership.
A proportional ownership. So if we were going to buy, I don't know, Woolworths, and there were 10 shares, and I owned a share, I own a tenth of it. Now, let's say Woolies goes in and buys back 5 shares on the open market. It never happens to this extreme, but just to keep the example nice and simple, all of a sudden, there are only 5 shares left. Now, the company is the company is the company.
Yes.
It's got the same earnings power as it did before I did the buyback, except now there's only 5 shares representing that value. So if I did not participate in that buyback, that is, if I didn't sell my shares back to the company, my shares are now worth twice as much.
Right.
And that's why companies do it. It is a means to, they will say, we are returning capital to shareholders, which I've never really liked because they're really only directly returning capital to the people who participated in the buyback.
That's true.
But they are returning capital back to investors in the sense that they are giving them an increased proportional ownership.
Right.
Sounds like a good idea.
And I think that is a good idea. Tell me why.
Well, like all things investing, it's sometimes a good idea.
But if I'm left with more of what I had before, that's got to be good, right?
Well, look, there is a scarcity problem and there's an opportunity cost problem. Mm-hmm. Just to get a little bit nerdy for a second, and the reality is that a company only has so much money with which to spend,
right?
And it can do a bunch of things. It can reinvest in the business. It can buy another business. It can pay a dividend. Or it can buy back its shares, or it can repay some debt. They're really the main things you have is if you're the CEO of a company, what are you going to do?
Right.
Now, your duty is to maximize return for shareholders. Mm-hmm. That's what you're paid to do, for better or worse. And so buying back shares can sometimes, in fact, more often than we'd like to admit, can be a horrible, horrible, horrible decision.
Yes.
Because it may be that paying down debt is the better option. It may be that paying a dividend is a better option. Even if you assume that there is an excess amount of cash and you want to return it to shareholders, even then buying back shares can be a really, really dumb idea. And that's because, like all of us, when we're buying shares back, we need to consider the price of those shares.
Right.
So just to stick with the example, Woolworths has its pros and cons. Let's not get into that right now. But I'll pretty happily state for the record that shares aren't worth $100 each.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say that the market just got in. We got a huge, euphoric bull market, and just shares just got there.
Yep.
They went all Bitcoin on us, and they got to $100 each. And the company said, hey, I'm going to buy back some shares.
Right.
Well, that is a dumb use because they now have to spend a lot more money to buy back the same number of shares, and that is going to the concentration benefit, so the opposite of dilution, is going to be far, far, far smaller. Do me a favor and say all of that in a concise, nice, easy, digestible way.
I'm going to do my best here. I'm going to turn it into the economist and investor's favorite analogy, which is
pizza.
There you go.
Pizza.
It's always pizza. So let's say you got a $20 pizza, and let's say you and I go halves. Mm-hmm. We got $10 slice each, right? Now, if I know that pizza's worth $20.
Mm-hmm.
It's objectively worth $20. Mm-hmm. At least that's the price on the market.
Yep.
If I said to you, Andrew, I want to buy back your half.
Mm-hmm.
If I gave you $50 to buy back your half of pizza, then I cost $20 for the full pizza. I'm dudding myself, right?
Stupid.
So I'm costing my shareholders, in this case, it's just me, but I'm costing you more money than if I use that money for something else.
Yep.
But if I said to you, hey, I'll buy back your pizza for $9, then it's a good deal for me because I get the whole pizza for $19 rather than $20. And so I'm actually adding value to the pizza owners.
Yep.
In this case, it's just me. But that kind of idea is where it comes from. So think about many, many slices, but the reality is still true. The company buys back a slice, redistributes the value of that slice amongst the rest of the owners. They'll get a bit more pizza. You've just got to make sure you're paying a decent price for that. Ideally, you want to pay less than the market price or less than the real value of that pizza.
Yes.
If you're paying too much for it, then it would have been cheaper to go and buy another pizza rather than buy it back the stuff.
Speaking of pizza, and I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole here, but Domino's is buying back its shares and has had a little bit of a program there in place for all the whole story that we should really touch on in a future podcast. But I would argue that they are doing it at a price that's probably not sensible. There are better uses for that capital. Yeah. I think it is true of growth companies that have a lot of growth opportunities. If you're going to get a good return on investment by opening up some more franchises or doing whatever you're going to, for God's sake, do that. Don't give us back the money. If you're going to be able to get a 20-30% return on investment, it's far better than most of us are ever going to be able to achieve reliably. So I think that's a good example. And you know what? There's a wonderful sign of a CEO who is a good capital allocator, which is really what a CEO's job is, is that they play both ends of the spectrum.
Right, exactly.
When shares are really, really, really cheap, they buy them back because existing shareholders are really enriched by doing that.
Yep.
When shares are really, really, really expensive, they do the opposite. They issue new shares.
Right.
It's a great way to, if Woolies was at $100, the CEO should be like, actually, hey, we're going to sell some more shares on the market. New shares. They're going to put them out there and they're going to get $100 for every share that they get.
So let me use my pizza analogy. If it's $20 pizza and you come to me and say, Scott, I really want to buy half your pizza for $15, I'm like, well, of course I'll sell it for you.
Yeah, take it. I'll give you some more slices.
And if I can buy it back from you later at $5, then I win both ways.
It is such a beautiful thing when you see. And that, in fact, if you're looking for to measure the quality of a CEO, there are some people out there who have just had wonderful examples of doing exactly that. It's a very, very, very prudent use of capital.
We're not going to go into it now, but I am going to say, just for the record, and just to add a bit of spice to the end of the conversation, I completely disagree with you about the Domino's example.
Oh, yeah?
If the company is actually worth more than $40, and it may well be, then it actually will end up being a very good use of capital.
And that is the question.
Right. So I think we can assume just because they're buying back shares at X dollars, or even because they've got growth opportunities elsewhere.
I didn't mean to say that. I 100% agree with you.
No, I'm not saying it's necessarily right. But if this company goes on to deliver some of the upside that it might, if the shares are $80 in a year's time, this will have been a masterstroke to buy them back now. If the shares are $20 in a couple of years' time, then it will be too expensive.
Total waste of money. Yeah, and that's the thing. Mate, I think we better wrap it up.
We
were going to do a high horse, but the biggest disappointment there is we miss out on the sound effect. Can we have it anyway, Liam, just for the sake of... Just to make me a little bit happier. Having said that, we're now going to wrap it all up.
Settle down, Winks. Settle down.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. So thank you so much for listening to us. We always enjoy your company.
And we do wonder why, too.
We do wonder why.
But we appreciate it.
Different strokes for different folks.
And if you like the podcast, tell your friends.
Tell your friends.
If you don't like the podcast, tell your enemies.
just keep it to yourself.
Tell somebody. No, tell your enemies. We want them to listen.
Oh, okay.
So if they don't like it, tell your enemies.
That's
so.
Why you're the marketing genius and I'm not.
Genius is a very loose term.
Give us a nice fat 5-star rating.
Please do.
Or
your favourite podcast app.
Or your favourite podcast app. And if you want a bit more foolish goodness, you can always go to www.fool.com.au/MMM.
Nice.
There you go.
Until next week, full on.
Full on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.